Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the February 10th, 2023 issue of The Week. Our cover drawing this week is a nighttime scene. In the background, we have bright lights and an ambulance with its lights flashing. In the foreground are five black police officers that their jackets say Memphis Police, looking at the viewer. And one of them has a taser in his hand, and you can see he's actively tasing. The headline is, Why Do Cops Kill? What the beating death of Tyree Nichols reveals about police culture. That is our first main story. We'll start with that. Videos show savagery of Memphis police killing. What happened? America was thrust into another anguished conversation around race and police violence this week after the release of graphic video showing five black Memphis police officers fatally beating a black man following a traffic stop. Body camera and surveillance videos released by the Memphis Police Department show Tyree Nichols, 29, being pulled from his car and pushed to the ground after being pulled over by members of an anti-crime unit, allegedly for reckless driving. "I didn't do anything," Nichols, a 150-pound father of a four-year-old who worked at FedEx, is heard to say. After being cursed at, pepper sprayed, and given 71 contradictory orders by cops, Nichols ran for his mother's house. When pursuing officers caught him, they held him down and assaulted him as he cried out for his mother, whose home was some 60 yards away. Over 3 minutes, he was kicked twice in the face, hit three times with a baton, sprayed twice, and punched six times in the head. Afterward, officers propped a slumping Nichols against a car while they laughed and fist-bumped one another. An ambulance arrived 22 minutes later and took Nichols to the hospital, where he died of internal bleeding 3 days later. The five officers were fired and indicted for second-degree murder, aggravated kidnapping, and other charges. All were members of the city's Scorpion Unit, created in 2021 to aggressively target high-crime neighborhoods. Two other officers were suspended pending further inquiry, including one white officer who used his taser on Nichols. Three emergency responders were fired for failing to conduct an adequate patient assessment. Protests were held in numerous cities. They remained largely nonviolent. Nichols' distraught mother called for peace and described her son as a gentle soul who loved skateboarding and taking photographs and loved me to death. Memphis Police Chief Sarilyn Davis, who is black, called the officers' actions unconscionable and said the fact that the accused officers are black takes race off the table. Rashad Robinson, president of the racial justice group Color of Change, was among many activists who disputed that view. What this illustrates is that we do have a deep problem that is beyond black and white, he said. It's about blue. What the editorial said. The vicious assault on Nichols is a jarring departure from the sickeningly common narrative of white officers killing unarmed black civilians, said the Los Angeles Times. But to those who say race wasn't a factor, a question. How often are law-abiding whites pulled from their cars and beaten to death? Race plays a major role in poverty, which in turn plays a role in how cops treat people. What the Memphis tragedy shows is that black cops can become instruments of a brutal law enforcement system that was largely shaped by historical white privilege. No decent person can watch the video without being horrified, said the New York Post. Yet it would only compound the horror to smear all police officers for the sins of a few. The tragedy will bring an outcry from anti-cop activists and officials who will claim this is proof of so-called systemic racism, but there's no logic to that claim, given that the arrested officers arrests were all black themselves. What the columnist said. Don't be fooled by the attacker's skin color, said Sean Harper in Forbes. Black officers receive the same training as white cops and are inducted into an organization that has racism deeply embedded into its DNA. Members of the activist class see everything through the simplistic lens of race, said Noah Rothman in commentary. Nichols' antagonists were black officers serving a black chief in a unit formed in response to an outcry from the black community about a surge in homicides. Individual cops are to blame here, but liberals insist on casting them as mere puppets of nefarious social forces. In city after city, anti-crime units like Scorpion have proven a disaster, said Radley Balco in the New York Times. Tasked with aggressively targeting crime hotspots, typically in street clothes and unmarked cars, they operate with far more leeway and less oversight than most officers. That invites abuses and attracts rogue cops with a cowboy mentality whose confrontational approach shatters the community trust that police forces require to keep people safe. The Memphis tragedy is the latest lesson in the limits of police reform, said Zach Cheney Rice in New York Magazine. Recruitment efforts built a Memphis force that's almost 60% black, headed by a black woman who's embraced widely touted reforms such as banning chokeholds and mandating the use of body cameras. But Nichols still died at police hands, like a record 1,176 Americans last year. His savage killing by black cops in a department that adopted reforms shows that the deeper problem is not individual prejudice and unaccountability, but something more fundamental to the job of policing. Controversy of the week, GOP House, McCarthy and the politics of payback. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy may not have any political principles, but the man pays his debt, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. To reward their support for his successful speakership bid, McCarthy has handed out plum committee assignments to the most extreme and weirdest members of the GOP clown caucus. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Jewish Space Lasers fame is headed to the Oversight Committee to tackle the urgent work of tying President Biden to his son Hunter's infamous laptop. The unhinged Representative Ronnie Jackson will join Greene on a new Origins of COVID Committee to air far-right suspicions that the sinister Dr. Anthony Fauci funded and covered up the creation of the deadly virus as a Chinese bioweapon. The hyperpartisan Representative Jim Jordan will chair a new weaponization of government committee to probe such deep state abuses as the FBI seeking interviews with a few dozen Fox News addled parents who made death threats against school board members. In another act of vengeance, said Frieda Gittes in CNN.com, McCarthy kicked Representatives Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell off the House Intelligence Committee. This was to punish them for their dogged investigations of former President Trump and to even the score for Democrats stripping Representatives Green and Paul Gosar of their committee assignments in the last Congress for making threats of political violence. If this is payback plain and simple, what's wrong with that? Asked Noah Rothman in commentary. When Democrats stripped Green and Gosar of their assignments in 2021, they shattered a longstanding House norm of letting minority parties choose their own committee members. Even many liberal pundits sounded warnings at the time that then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was setting a dubious precedent that Republicans were sure to follow at their earliest opportunity. Now we're there. McCarthy also is mustering votes to boot Representative Ilhan Omar, a far-left anti-American radical who has made three blatantly anti-Semitic remarks about Jews dictating U.S. policy and her nonstop attacks on Israel. Republicans are amply justified in sidelining her. The GOP might be relishing the taste of power, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post, but it comes at a price. Its conspiracy theorists will now be forced to produce actual evidence to back up the half-baked accusations that played so well on Fox News when they were in the minority. They will have to explain their convoluted, illogical theories to a skeptical public. 73% of Americans, including 48% of Republicans, already think the House GOP isn't paying enough attention to the country's real issues. McCarthy won't be able to control his bomb throwers, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. With so many committees overloaded with loons, it's but a matter of time before things blow up. But craziness is a feature, not a bug, of McCarthy's caucus, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. As he and other Republicans learned during the Benghazi hearings, the mere fact of an investigation is all it takes to reify Fox News phantasms in the eyes of the GOP base. Evidence won't matter to flame-throwing fanaticists like Green and Jordan. Fox will eat up and amplify their allegations. The media will dutifully report them, and Republicans will hope something, anything, will stick. Get ready. For the next 2 years, it will be all investigations, all the time. It was a good week for facing reality. After NFL star quarterback Tom Brady, 45, announced he was retiring for good. Ex-wife Gisele Bündchen wished him wonderful things in this new chapter of your life. It was a good week for plain English after the Associated Press amended a policy advising staff to avoid dehumanizing the labels such as the poor, the mentally ill, the French. Online wags had wondered if people in France should now be called people experiencing Frenchness or people assigned French at birth. And it was a good week for the Scots after the U.S. Department of Agriculture was petitioned to legalize importation of Scotland's offal-filled national dish, haggis. Regulations prevent the use of lung tissue in commercial food products, which the petition says makes no scientific sense. But it was a bad week for writers, with BuzzFeed's announcement only a month after laying off 180 employees that it will start using an AI chatbot to generate its trademark quizzes and listicles. CEO Jonah Peretti called it a new era of creativity. It was a bad week for postgraduate studies after a 29-year-old New Jersey woman was charged with using a fake birth certificate to enroll in high school. Hye Jong Shin lasted 4 days at New Brunswick High School before being found out and barred. Finally, it was a bad week for the obsessively neat. After tidiness guru Marie Kondo, 38, admitted that since welcoming her third child, the author of such international bestsellers as The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up has kind of given up on that. And a short and other news piece. COVID emergency to end. The Biden administration said this week that it will let the COVID national and public health emergency declaration expire in May as the pandemic enters an endemic phase. After the emergency declaration ends, much of the cost-free coverage of COVID vaccines and treatments will also end, and more people will have to pay for them out of pocket. Millions of Americans are likely to lose Medicaid coverage, which was expanded during the pandemic. Biden's executive order providing student loan relief during the pandemic also will end. With more than 500 Americans still dying every day from COVID, the White House said an immediate end to the emergency, which House Republicans want, would create wide-ranging chaos and uncertainty. this week's briefing is titled The Fentanyl Scourge. Overdose deaths from the powerful, easy-to-produce drug have soared. How did this happen? How dangerous is fentanyl? Developed in 1960, the synthetic opioid is still used as a prescription painkiller through controlled-release patches, pills, lozenges, and sprays. But in its illicit form, it is pure, highly addictive, and often lethal. A narcotic 50 times more potent than heroin, fentanyl can kill in doses as small as 2 milligrams, an amount that could fit on a sharpened pencil tip. Fentanyl was responsible for two-thirds of the more than 107,000 fatal overdoses in the U.S. in 2021. More Americans ages 18 to 49 die of fentanyl overdose than from any other single cause. It is a new, deeper, more deadly threat than we have ever seen, said Ann Milgram of the Drug Enforcement Administration. Just one pill is dangerous. How did it become so prevalent? The drug is extremely strong, fast-acting, and easy to make. Some of its precursor chemicals are widely available because they're also used in the manufacture of other drugs, pesticides, and soap. In the 2010s, federal officials cracked down on the proliferation of prescription opioids after overdose deaths caused by them rose from 3,442 in 1999 to nearly 17,000 in 2017. Addicts sought highs elsewhere, first through heroin, then fentanyl, which produces an even more powerful state of euphoria at a much lower cost and usually does not require the use of needles. Officials were slow to recognize the threat, but from 2017 to 2022, the amount of fentanyl seized by border officials jumped ninefold. The 16,200 pounds intercepted last year, officials say, is likely only 5 to 10% of the total that makes it across. During the stress and widespread unemployment of the pandemic, demand for the drug surged. 9 million Americans abused opioids in some way in 2020, according to the Department of Health and Human Services. Overdoses from synthetic opioids jumped 56%. Where is fentanyl coming from? From 2014 to 2019, most of it was brought in from China, sometimes in small packages sent through the mail and sometimes smuggled across land borders by Mexican cartels. Since then, through the Sinaloa and Jalisco New Generation cartels, have cut out the middleman, making their own fentanyl powder and pills with raw materials from China and India. Less than 1% is smuggled north by individual migrants, the Cato Institute says. Most of it is tucked into elaborate hiding places inside the roughly 80 million cars and trucks that cross the border legally every year at checkpoints, with U.S. citizens doing much of the smuggling. Only about 1% of cars and 6% of trucks are searched because of the volume and manpower constraints. In the U.S., drug dealers often mix fentanyl with other drugs such as heroin and cocaine, whose highs it intensifies. Sometimes fentanyl is sold as itself, including in rainbow fentanyl tablets made to look like candy and marketed to teens. What is the impact of these tablets? More than 1,800 Americans ages 10 to 19 died of a fentanyl overdose between 2019 and 2021. Some obtained the drug via social media dealers, thinking they were getting bootleg versions of Xanax, Percocet, Adderall, or other prescription meds. The University of San Diego professor Tim Mackey, who tracks the drug trade on social media via artificial intelligence, detects 10,000 new drug-related accounts each month. Last week, a congressional roundtable focused on the role of Snapchat, a platform where encrypted, temporary visual messages allow dealers to operate covertly in the youth fentanyl crisis. Zach Didier, a 17-year-old Eagle Scout, bought what a Snapchat dealer advertised as Percocet tablets in 2020, but was actually fentanyl. He died shortly after taking two. "You think if there's a problem, you'll see red flags," said Laura Didier, his mother. "But that's old thinking about drug behavior. This can happen so quickly. Can anything be done?" At Congress' direction, border agents are installing $480 million worth of high-energy scanners to detect anomalies in vehicles crossing the border in hope of catching more fentanyl smugglers. The Biden administration, meanwhile, has adopted some public health officials' call for a harm reduction strategy, making the prevention of death a priority. That includes providing medications such as methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone to help treat opioid addiction, training people in the use of naloxone to save people from overdose. Some government agencies are also providing test strips that let people check other drugs for the presence of fentanyl. But those strips are banned in 20 states, and critics claim they only further encourage drug use. Meanwhile, a more definitive solution remains out of reach. "Our drug control strategy is an embarrassment," said John P. Walters, who served as drug czar under the Clinton and Bush administrations. "It doesn't begin to propose a way of reversing this problem." And time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. The failure of single-payer health care. Utopian leftists like Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders still insist that a single-payer system would save American health care, said John Fund and David Simon. But just look at the pain and suffering that the U.K.'s government-run National Health Service is inflicting on the British people. The NHS's costs are soaring out of control, and 2.9 million patients recently seeking care had to wait 18 weeks to start treatment. The inability to get prompt treatment, statistics show, is literally killing hundreds of sick Britons every week, which is why those who can afford it are turning to private doctors. All over the world, single-payer healthcare systems are experiencing similar problems. In Canada's single-payer system, the median wait for treatment after a referral last year was an absurd 27.4 weeks. In the U.S., long backlogs for government-run health care through the Department of Veterans Affairs led the VA to offer veterans the option of private care. One out of three vets now sees doctors outside the VA, and healthy competition has improved the quality of care, the Biden administration says. If the U.S. adopted Sanders' Medicare for All, it would only bankrupt the system more quickly and harm and perhaps kill many Americans. DeSantis' biggest weakness. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is campaigning for the Republican presidential nomination as a culture warrior par excellence, said Jamel Bowie. But the strategic success of his war on woke has deliberately obscured a major DeSantis weakness, his radical and unpopular views on social insurance and the welfare state. During his three terms in Congress, DeSantis was one of the founders of the Radical Freedom Caucus and an especially fierce opponent of entitlement programs such as Social Security, Medicare, and the Affordable Care Act. He spearheaded the 2013 GOP effort to shut down the government to force repeal of the ACA, which now provides affordable insurance to more than 35 million Americans, and voted in favor of cutting $250 million from Social Security and Medicare. In his 2011 book, DeSantis condemned government-mandated wealth redistribution as unconstitutional despotism. And in 2017, he voted for a massive tax cut for corporations, high earners, and wealthy heirs. Donald Trump reportedly plans to attack DeSantis for supporting entitlement cuts. If Democrats want to neutralize DeSantis as a political force, they should warn voters he plans to make big cuts in the safety net to benefit the rich. This column comes from Mexico. How deep is complicity with cartels? What did Mexico's presidents know about their top cops' dealings with the Sinaloa drug cartel? That's what Mexicans hope to learn from the trial of former Secretary of Public Security Genaro García Luna, which started last week in New York, said Manuel Ajeno. From 2006 to 2012, serving under two presidents and partnering with the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, García Luna was tasked with leading the Mexican government's war on drug trafficking. Instead, U.S. prosecutors say he took millions of dollars in bribes to turn a blind eye to the vicious Sinaloa cartel, even tipping off members about potential arrests. García Luna's alleged crookedness was long known, or at least suspected, but it wasn't until after the blockbuster 2019 trial of Sinaloa boss Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, in which testimony directly implicated him, that he was arrested. Now Mexicans are watching the García Luna trial with morbid curiosity to see whether he will implicate his immediate bosses, former presidents Vicente Fox and Felipe Calderón. There's evidence that Calderón, at least, knew that García Luna was a dirty cop. As a security minister, official sent a letter telling him so. If García Luna cuts a deal to tell all, the scandal could engulf our most powerful political leaders. And it's time for our in-depth article, The Last Word. Titled this week, My Pursuit of Zero Plastic. Plastic is ubiquitous in the modern world, said A.J. Jacobs in the New York Times, and I wanted to find out if I could spend a day without relying on it. It didn't go well at all. On the morning of the day I had decided to go without using plastic products or even touching plastic, I opened my eyes and put my bare feet on the carpet, which is made of nylon, a type of plastic. I was roughly 10 seconds into my experiment, and I had already committed a violation. Since its invention more than a century ago, plastic has crept into every aspect of our lives. It's hard to even go a few minutes without touching this durable, lightweight, wildly versatile substance. Plastic has made possible thousands of modern conveniences, but it has come with downsides, especially for the environment. Last week, in a 24-hour experiment, I tried to live without it altogether in an effort to see what plastic stuff we can't do without and what we may be able to give up. Most mornings, I check my iPhone soon after waking up. On the appointed day, this was not possible, given that in addition to aluminum, iron, lithium, gold, and copper, each iPhone contains plastic. In preparation for the experiment, I had stashed my device in a closet. I quickly found that not having access to it left me feeling disoriented and bold, as if I were some sort of intrepid time traveler. I made my way to the bathroom, only to stop myself before I went in. Could you open the door for me? I asked my wife, Julie. The doorknob has a plastic coating. She opened it for me, letting out a, this is going to be a long day sigh. My morning hygiene routine needed a total revamp, which required detailed preparations in the days before my experiment. I could not use my regular toothpaste, toothbrush, shampoo, or liquid soap. all of which were encased in plastic or made of plastic. Fortunately, there is a huge industry of plastic-free products targeted at eco-conscious consumers, and I had bought an array of them. A haul that included a bamboo toothbrush with bristles made of wild boar hair from Life Without Plastic. The bristles are completely sterilized, Jay Sinha, the company's co-owner, had assured me when I spoke with him the week before. Instead of toothpaste, I had a jar of gray charcoal mint toothpaste pellets. I popped one in, chewed it, sipped water, and brushed. It was nice and minty, although the ash-colored spit was unsettling. I liked my shampoo bar. A shampoo bar is just what it sounds like, a bar of shampoo. Mine was scented with pink grapefruit and vanilla, and lathered up well. According to shampoo bar advocates, it is also cheaper than bottled shampoo on a per-wash basis. One bar can last 80 showers, which is good because plastic-free life can be expensive. Package-free, a sleek outlet in the NoHo neighborhood of Manhattan that abuts Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop store, sells zinc and stainless steel razor for $84. Getting dressed was also a challenge, given that so many clothing items include plastic. I had ordered a pair of wool pants that promised to be plastic-free, but they had not arrived. In their stead, I chose a pair of Old Banana Republic chinos. The tag said 100% cotton, but when I had checked the day before with a very helpful Banana Republic public relations representative, it turned out to be a little more complicated. The main fabric is indeed 100% cotton, but there was plastic lurking in the zipper tape, the internal waistband, woven label, pocketing, and threads, the representative told me. I cut my thumb trying to slice off the black brand label with an all-metal knife. Instead of a Band-Aid, yes, plastic, I used some gummed paper tape to stop the bleeding. Happily, my underwear did not represent a plastic violation. Blue boxers from Cottonique, made of 100% organic cotton with a cotton drawstring. For my upper body, I lucked out. Our friend Kristen had knitted my wife a sweater for a birthday present. It had rectangles of blue and purple, and it was 100% merino wool. "Could I borrow Kristen's sweater for the day?" I asked Julie. "You're going to stretch it out," Julie said. "It's for planet Earth," I reminded her. Before my day of no plastic, I'd called Gabby Salazar, a social scientist who studies what motivates people to support environmental causes, and asked for her advice as I headed into my plastic-free day. "It might be better to start small," Salazar said. "Start by creating a single habit, like always carrying a stainless steel water bottle. After you've got that down, you start another habit, like taking produce bags to the grocery. You build up gradually. That's how you make real change. Otherwise, you'll just be overwhelmed." The world produces about 400 million metric tons of plastic waste each year, according to the United Nations report. About half is tossed out after a single use. The report noted that we have become addicted to single-use plastic products with severe environmental, social, economic, and health consequences. I'm one of the addicts. I did an audit, and I'd estimate that I toss about 800 plastic items in the garbage a year. Takeout containers, pens, cups, Amazon packages with foam inside, and more. There's some debate over when plastic entered the world, but many date it to 1855, when British metallurgist Alexander Parkes patented a thermoplastic material as a waterproof coating for fabrics. He called the substance parkosine. Over the decades, labs across the world birthed other types, all with similar chemistry. Plastic manufacturing ramped up for World War II and was crucial to the war effort, providing nylon parachutes and plexiglass aircraft windows. That was followed by a post-war boom, said Susan Frankel, author of Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, a book on the history and science of plastic. Plastic went into things like Formica counters, refrigerator liners, car parts, clothing, shoes, just all sorts of stuff that was designed to be used for a while, she said. Then things took a turn. Where we really started to get into trouble is when it started going into single-use stuff, Frenkel said. I call it prefab litter. Early in my no plastic day, I started to see the world differently. Everything looked menacing, like it might be harboring hidden polymers. The kitchen was particularly fraught. Anything I could use for cooking was off-limits. The toaster, the oven, the microwave, even leftovers were a no-go. My son waved a plastic baggie filled with French toast. You want some of this? Yes, I did. Instead, I decided to go foraging for raw food items. I left my building using the stairs rather than the elevator with its plastic buttons and walked to a health food store near our apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I brought along several bags of varying sizes, all of them cotton. I also had two glass containers. At the store, I filled up one of my cotton bags with apples and oranges. On close inspection, I noticed that each rind had a sticker with a code. Another likely violation, but I ignored it. At the bulk bins, I scooped walnuts and oatmeal into my glass dishes using a washed steel ladle I had brought from home. The bins themselves were plastic, which I ignored because I was hungry. I went to the cashier, at which point it was time to pay, which was a problem. Credit cards were out, so was my iPhone's Apple Pay. Paper money was another violation. Although U.S. paper currency is made mainly of cotton and linen, each bill likely contains synthetic fibers, and the higher denominations have a security thread made of plastic to prevent counterfeiting. To be safe, I had brought along a cotton sack full of coins. Yes, a big old heavy sack with quarters, dimes, and pennies, about $60 worth that I had withdrawn from Citibank and my kids' piggy banks. At the checkout counter, I started stacking quarters as quickly as I could between nervous glances at the customers behind me. I'm really sorry this is taking so long, I said. That's okay, the cashier said. I meditate every morning so I can deal with turmoil like this. He added that he appreciated my commitment to the environment. It was the first positive feedback I'd received. I counted out $19.02, exact change, and went home to eat my breakfast. Nuts and oranges on a metal cookie tray, which I balanced on my lap. A couple of hours later, in search of a plastic-free lunch, I walked to Linwich, a sandwich and salad shop in my neighborhood. I arrived early in the afternoon, toting my rectangular glass dish and bamboo cutlery. Can you make the salad in this glass container? I asked, holding it up. 1 minute, the man behind the counter said tersely. He called over a manager who said, okay. Victory, but the manager then rejected my follow-up request to use my steel scooper. After lunch, I headed to Central Park, figuring that this was a spot in Manhattan where I could relax in a plastic-free environment. I took the subway there, which scored me more violations since the trains themselves have plastic parts and you need a metro card or smartphone to get through the turnstiles. At least I didn't sit in one of those plastic orange seats. I had brought my own, an unpainted fold-up Nordic-style teak chair, hard and austere. It was what I'd been using at the apartment to avoid the plastic-tainted chairs and couches. Walking through Central Park, I spotted dental floss picks, a black plastic knife, a plastic bag. Back home, I recorded some of my impressions. I wrote on paper with an unpainted cedar pencil from a zero-waste pencil 10 set. After a while, I went to get a drink of water, which brings up perhaps the most pervasive foe of all, one I hadn't even mentioned yet, microplastics. These tiny particles are everywhere. in the water we drink, in the air we breathe, in the oceans. They come from, among other things, degraded plastic litter. Are they harmful to us? I talked with several scientists, and the general answer I got was, we don't know yet. I think we're going to have an improved understanding in the next few years, said Todd Gowen, an environmental research consultant. But those who are extra cautious can use products that promise to filter microplastics from water and air. I had bought a pitcher by LifeStraw that contains a membrane microfilter. Of course, the pitcher itself had plastic parts, so I couldn't use it on the big day. Instead, the night before, I spent some time at the sink filtering water and filling up mason jars. At about 9 p.m., I took our dog for her nightly walk. I was using a 100% cotton leash I bought online. I had ditched the poop bags. Even the sustainable ones I found were made with recycled or plant-based plastic. Instead, I carried a metal spatula. Thankfully, I didn't have to use it. At 10:30 p.m., exhausted, I lay down on my makeshift bed, cotton sheets on the wood floor, since my mattress and pillows are plasticky. I woke up the next morning glad to have survived my ordeal and be reunited with my phone, but also with a feeling of defeat. I had made 164 violations by my count. As Salazar had predicted, I felt overwhelmed and also uncertain. Is it a good idea to use boar's hair toothbrushes, tea tree deodorant, microplastic filtering devices, and paper straws? Or does the trouble of using these things make everyone so bonkers that they actually end up damaging the cause? I called Salazar for a pep talk. Remember, she told me, it's not about plastic being the enemy. It's about single use as the enemy. It's the culture of using something once and throwing it away. I'll start with small things, building up habits. I like the shampoo bar, and I can take produce bags to the grocery store. I might even pack my steel water bottle and bamboo cutlery for my trips to Linwich. And from there, who knows? And I'll proudly wear the Keep the Sea Plastic Free t-shirt that I bought online in the days leading up to the experiment. It's just 10% polyester. This article originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll read a couple of the health and science pieces this week, starting with Earth's mysterious spinning core. 3,000 miles beneath Earth's surface lies its inner core, a superheated ball of iron somewhat smaller than the moon. In the 1990s, scientists made the startling and disputed claim that this fiery sphere was spinning at a slightly faster rate than the crust and mantle surrounding it. Now, reports the Washington Post, the same team says that over the past decade, the inner core decelerated to rotate in sync with everything else until it is now lagging behind. This is no cause for panic, though. Authors believe the same thing happened in the late 1960s and early 1970s, suggesting that the rotation speed may follow a 70-year cycle. The inner core plays an important role in the dynamic Earth. The energy it releases is thought to move the liquid in the outer core, generating electric currents that in turn spawn the magnetic field that wraps around the planet and protects the surface from damaging cosmic rays. The new research stems from measurements of the seismic waves from earthquakes that pass through the core, and not all scientists are convinced that the study interprets them correctly. But many agree more investigation into the rate of spin is warranted. It's probably benign, said John Vidal, a geophysicist with the University of Southern California who wasn't involved in the study. But we don't want to have things we don't understand deep in the earth. The bacteria clearing oceans. It's a riddle that has long puzzled scientists. Of the 14 million tons of plastic thought to enter our ocean each year, only about 1% is ever detected in sampling surveys. A new study suggests that some of the missing garbage is being eaten up by bacteria that live in seawater. Researchers at the Royal Netherlands Institute for Sea Research treated plastic with UV light to mimic sunlight, which broke it down into smaller chunks. They then fed it to Rhodococcus rubra, a common bacterium that is known to be able to transform harmful pollutants into harmless molecules. Sure enough, the bacteria did its work, turning the plastic into carbon dioxide. The researchers estimate that Rhodococcus rubra alone can probably break down more than 1% of available plastic in a year. But while it might be technically possible to grow more bacteria and scale the process up, doing so could produce harmful levels of carbon dioxide. Much better than cleaning up its prevention is prevention, co-author Mike Goodrian tells the Daily Telegraph, and only we humans can do that. Over on the Talking Points page, we have hashtag died suddenly, anti-vaxxers fear campaign. Did you know that Americans vaccinated against COVID are dropping dead in droves? Or that many well-known people who've died over the last year, including Lisa Marie Presley, comedian Bob Saget, and soccer journalist Grant Wall, all succumb to damage caused by vaccination? This is all part of a new conspiracy theory that anti-vaxxers called hashtag died suddenly, said Miles Klee in Rolling Stone. The Twitter campaign exploits the anti-science, anti-government paranoia now rampant in the U.S. and posits that global elites are using COVID vaccination as a depopulation campaign. Anti-vaxxers even contend that DeMar Hamlin, the Buffalo Bills player who suffered cardiac arrest on the field last month, was actually a vaccine victim, and that the recovering Hamlin seen in public is a body double. More than 650 million doses of COVID vaccines have been safely given in the U.S. and billions worldwide, said Jonathan Reiner in CNN.com. There is no evidence to suggest athletes or regular folk have been dying due to the vaccines. For anti-vaxxers, though, these tragedies are just another crass opportunity to promote vaccine disinformation. But you know how conspiracy theories work, said Nick Cotoggio in the Dispatch. Give believers contradictory evidence, and they double down on their beliefs. Anti-vaxxers now even contend that vaccinated people shed spike proteins that can kill others, warn against getting blood transfusions, and refer to themselves as purebloods. Seeing cranks talk each other into believing that people are dropping dead in mass from the jab is darkly funny, but this silly phenomenon has worrisome implications for both public health and our public discourse. Hashtag died suddenly is a sign of an unhealthy political culture, a symptom of a society with a fever. Elon Musk has encouraged that fever to spike, said Caitlin Tiffany in The Atlantic, as Twitter's owner must change the site's rule to give anti-vaxxers free rein to spout disinformation. He tweeted himself that he believes the COVID vaccine causes dangerous side effects. A @died suddenly Twitter account with more than 270,000 followers is promoting a bogus documentary that's been viewed nearly 20 million times. U.S. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene is among its fans. Until recently, the anti-vaxxers and other conspiracy theorists were forced to operate on alternative websites. But now that Twitter's guardrails are down, the difference between alt and mainstream is getting slimmer. Durham probe. how Barr weaponized the DOJ. Just as House Republicans suspect, rogue government officials have politicized the Justice Department in a jaw-dropping abuse of power, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. They've got the wrong culprit, however. In a blockbuster report, the New York Times paints a devastating picture of the investigation of Special Counsel John Durham, whom then-Attorney General William Barr tasked in 2018 with pursuing the baseless conspiracy theory that the FBI and Robert Mueller probe into then-President Donald Trump's ties to Russia was the result of a deep state conspiracy cooked up by the Hillary Clinton campaign. Pushed relentlessly by Barr to prove Trump was wronged, Durham spent more than 3 years on an investigation that yielded just two flimsy prosecutions that juries took only hours to reject. Durham's witch hunt was so egregiously unprofessional that his top aide and several other prosecutors quit in protest. The Times report makes clear that Barr was the driving force behind an abusive, partisan, and unhinged investigation, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. The whole point of appointing a special counsel is to wall off a politically sensitive investigation. But Durham and Barr met regularly for drinks and dinner, and Durham adopted Barr's Fox News brain beliefs that Trump had been the victim of a conspiracy. To do so, both men ignored a mountain of evidence assembled by Mueller that Trump eagerly welcomed Russia's 2016 election interference. Meanwhile, the conservative media breathlessly hyped up Durham's probe, predicting it would put a host of Trump's evil tormentors in prison. At one point, Italian intelligence officials gave Durham and Barr a potentially explosive tip, said Jack Holmes in Esquire. It implicated Trump in possible financial crimes. Barr assigned Durham to investigate that tip, which, for some mysterious reason, went nowhere. So much for Barr's campaign to rehabilitate his image, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com. After he quit during Trump's final days, Barr wanted to be seen not as a pitiful lackey of a failed former president, but as a man with some semblance of integrity. But it's now undeniable that Barr turned his DOJ into an extension of Donald Trump's political operation, and he'll be remembered as a political hack. The evidence is crystal clear. The Russia scandal was real, and the Durham investigation was a fiasco. And some shorter notes. Work absences due to illness have climbed to an all-time annual high in the U.S., largely because of COVID. Nearly 1.6 million U.S. workers called in sick each month on average in 2022, about 700,000 more than in 2019. An estimated 500,000 to 1 million Americans have left the workforce altogether because of long COVID, which affects about 7.5% of the population, according to the CDC. New York City this winter is nearing an all-time record for its longest period of time with no measurable snow. The city will pass that record of 332 days this week, with no snow predicted anytime soon. Since the Biden administration instituted a new asylum policy requiring migrants to apply from their home countries, arrests at the U.S.-Mexico border have plunged by nearly 50%, federal officials report. Arrests have dropped from between 8,000 and 9,000 a day at the end of 2022 to between 4,000 and 5,000. Nearly 1.9 million Floridians gained Medicaid coverage from March 2020 to December 2022 under federal COVID emergency rules. Since Florida is one of the 11 states that did not expand Medicaid under Obamacare, nearly 1 million residents will abruptly lose health coverage in April when the federal emergency ends. On the poll watch, in a head-to-head matchup between Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former President Donald Trump, 52% of Republican voters choose DeSantis, 30% choose Trump, and 15% remain undecided. In a 10-candidate field, DeSantis gets 39% of the vote, followed by Trump with 28%, Mike Pence with 9%, Nikki Haley and Liz Cheney tied with 4%, with 13% undecided. And we've got time for a couple of quotes today. We'll start with one from Blaise Pascal, the philosopher, who says, "All of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone." And novelist Amor Towles, quoted in the Arizona Republic, gives us, "There is a difference between being resigned to a situation and reconciled to it." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.